Performance is at the heart of this relationship. It's the authentic hallmark of a mature profession. A code of ethics makes explicit the primary goals and values of the profession. When individuals become nurses, they make a moral commitment to uphold the values and special obligations expressed in their code of ethics. The code for nurses is based on a belief about the nature of individuals, nursing, health, and society. Nursing encompasses the protection, promotion, and restoration of health, the prevention of illness, and the alleviation of suffering in the care of clients, including individuals, families, groups, and communities. Since clients themselves are the primary decision makers in matters concerning their own health, treatment, and well-being, the goal of nursing action is to support and enhance the client's decision making and self-determination in healthcare matters to the greatest extent possible. In this context, health is not necessarily an end in itself, but rather a means to a life that is optimal from the client's perspective. The Code of Ethics provides a framework within which nurses make ethical decisions and discharge their responsibilities to the public, to other members of the health team, and to the profession. ONA believes that competent adults have the right to participate in decisions relating to their health care, including the decision to have medical or surgical means or procedures to prolong their lives, provided, withheld, or withdrawn. The Oregon Nurses Association supports legislation that establishes statutes for providing, withholding, or withdrawing life-sustaining procedures, and that sets forth procedures to establish power of attorney for health care decisions related to death with dignity. ONA supports inclusion of mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration in the concept of life-sustaining procedure. Based on recent court decisions and research on the effects of withdrawal of nutrition and hydration on the dying person. Nutrition and hydration should be treated as other vital functions subject to withholding and withdrawal according to a person's decision. ONA has three concerns regarding Senate Bill 20, Section 4 sub 1, 5 sub 1, and 6 sub 1. On page 3, there is a provision in Section 4 sub 1, line 5, that a directive can be made when the declarant is cognitively stable. ONA supports that the directive can be revoked only when a client is also cognitively stable. ONA does not support that the revocation can occur without regard to the declarant's mental condition. Revocation when a client is not cognitively stable will violate or at the very least infringe upon the decision process that the client has previously arrived at when cognitively stable. It is necessary for the declarant to be of sound mental status when reaching the initial decision to provide, withhold, or withdraw life-sustaining procedures, as well as participation in the revocation of the decision to participate in this process. In proposed ORS 97.990, Section 5, sub 1, line 12, the physician has flexibility to implement the directive of the declarant. ONA is concerned about the lack of involvement of the declarant and the family in the specific implementation of the directive. Flexibility is necessary to individualize this process. Collaboration with the declarant and the family or significant others would facilitate appropriate implementation of the directive. Section 6 sub 1 on line 3, page 3, line 25, cites when a person is in the active and natural process of dying as determined by the physician. It is difficult to apply the definition of the active and natural process of dying in the clinical setting. Because of the inherent ambiguity in the definition, ONA strongly suggests the language be clarified. ONA has a question regarding Section 7, sub 1 on page 4. References made that the person has been comatose for at least 60 days. Nurses have observed situations in which a patient may become comatose for a period of time, regain consciousness, and then relapse into a coma. Therefore, does 60 days refer to 60 consecutive days of lack of consciousness or a total of 60 days of lack of consciousness? ONA supports ORS 97.990, Section 9, page 4, line 33 of Senate Bill 20. We concur with the importance of a physician, health professional, or healthcare facility not being subject to civil liability or violation of any professional oath, affirmation, or standard of care. Registered nurses have a respect for human dignity and the uniqueness of the client. Clients have the moral right to determine what will be done with their own person, to be assisted with weighing the benefits and burdens of options in their treatment, and to accept, refuse, or terminate treatment without coercion. In conclusion, ONA supports Senate Bill 20 and urges the Senate Judiciary Committee to consider the aforementioned concerns. ONA also supports Senate Bill 21, which sets forth procedures to establish power of attorney in health care. Section 4, sub 2 on page 3, lines 10 to 13, prohibits owners, operators, or employees of a health care facility from serving as attorney-in-fact for health care. The wording of the subsection is cumbersome and is written with a double pronoun. Because a family member of a registered nurse employee may be a patient in the same facility, ONA is concerned that the language in Senate Bill 21 will clearly allow the nurse to serve as attorney-in-fact for health care. Our reading of Section 4, sub 2 indicates this would be permitted, but because this subsection is unclear, ONA asked the committee for clarification. As indicated earlier in this testimony, ONA is concerned about revocation. Section 10, sub 1 indicates revocation can occur without regard to the mental or physical condition of the principal. To reiterate ONA's position, the principal needs to be in a cognitively stable condition to invoke and revoke a procedure to establish power of attorney for health care. Thank you for considering this testimony on behalf of Oregon Nurses Association.
Questions? All right. Senator Wires?
How is a person going to, if they're dying, a lot of people get kind of confused. How are they going to be able to establish that they were in a cognitive state if they want to revoke? Doesn't that invite somebody saying, well, they're not in a cognitive state, so we're not going to let them revoke?
Well, I think that's what we're saying, that the consideration should be given to the, if they are now cognitively impaired, and they had a directive, and their decision now goes against that directive, we're saying that the original directive should stand, and that the person, in order to revoke that directive, needs to be cognitively...
Well, what kind of a directive? Aren't you thinking of a directive to not do certain things and keep them alive?
Well, I think it would probably be either one.
Is that the kind of directives we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now, if a person is given a directive, don't do certain things to keep me alive... Mm-hmm. And then
they sometimes change their mind.
Right. And if they change their mind, and you're going to say, well, you've got to be cognitively stable to make that decision, isn't that tantamount to saying that a person, it's going to be possible for medical professionals to say, you're not competent to change your mind. So we're now not going to give you the life-sustaining things that you're now asking for. What's the person then supposed to do to show they're cognitively stable? Ask for a hearing? Or?
Well, I would say the same procedures that you do to say that somebody is cognitively, cognitively stable is, the words are not very descriptive of what we do, but in the clinical setting, it's a big dilemma to be confronted with that. And if you have people who make a directive when they are cognitively stable, and they become confused, and it's the opposite decision, it's just very problematic.
Just getting a little bit of...
I was kind of interested in hearing the answer to that question.
I'm sorry, I thought she was about to...
You were trying to explain you're in a situation, a clinical situation.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, as a clinician, it's very difficult to go along with a decision that is made when someone's confused. That's very different from a decision they made when they were not. And I'm not sure we have the answer, but I think that would be a concern that needs to be looked at.
Well, rather than another question, I'll make a short statement. I think you exposed yourself to the criticism. This looks like once you say, I don't want to have certain things done to keep me alive, you may have trouble changing your mind. Mm-hmm. And then, as in a way, that would be a disincentive for me if I were explaining to somebody. I would certainly very carefully warn them. Now, you may have a lot of trouble changing your mind because you get in the hospital and you don't have your teeth and you don't have your glasses and all those things that happen to people when they're old and they're dying. You may have an awful hard time convincing somebody that, you are still have power enough to change your mind.
But I think that the reverse is also true, that you wouldn't have any assurance that you make a directive today and you become confused and say something else, that it's going to be acted on when that, you know, as an individual, I would be concerned about making a directive, thinking that at some point I would get confused and say that I wanted something that I didn't originally when I was cognitively stable, that I would get those things.
I agree with that, but
I think it's a two-sided issue that it's not very clear, as much of these issues are.
But I think the side of the issue you're opening yourself to with the position you've taken is the one that where the criticism comes from people who say they're trying to fix it so they can...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I think it doesn't solve the problem then, because you're still going to... Mm-hmm. Then the directive essentially maybe doesn't mean much. If things change when you get to the point where the decisions have to be made and somebody says, well, you know, it's the same on both sides of the issue, that the directive then maybe doesn't have any meaning, because it can change.
Further questions?
Yeah, I'm about to...
Go ahead.
Did you hear the question I asked earlier? Could you comment on that?
I wish you'd ask it again.
Well, if a situation arises under this bill where IVs can be removed, it's my understanding that nursing home nurses and other nursing personnel object to having people there alive but without hydration, because that makes the skin become very vulnerable to decubitus ulcers, and that is a concern to them, whether or not the person is conscious enough to feel the pain. Just they've been through their training and orientation is to at all costs avoid people getting decubitus ulcers, and it's almost like an admission that the care is substandard to have that happen, and then to remove, and that can lead to infection, which can threaten other people in the institution, and so on. That I was told when I was in a situation like this in my law practice, that was very threatening to health care professionals, particularly nurses. I was wondering about your comment about that.
A couple of things. I think when you take away the hydration, people don't live very long. I mean, they can't live a long time without without fluids. And for a pressure sore to develop is possible under those circumstances. I think from as a clinician, I don't see that as a big problem. And I think that people in long-term care facilities, they do like to give good care, but when people are dying, or even if they're not dying, if they're in a very poor physical condition or have certain diseases, sometimes there is nothing we can do to prevent complications from occurring. And that's very hard for some people to live with, but it is nevertheless true. And the other thing, I think that in a lot of the long-term care facilities, a lot of that pressure comes from the outside regulatory bodies who do not ever want to see any complications of any kind. And like I said, we cannot always prevent them, no matter what we do. So I think that concern is from a couple of different sources.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Counselor.
Ms. Miller, if I could direct you back to the power of attorney bill on section 4, in terms of allowing persons who are related to the principal to serve as attorneys in fact,
mm-hmm.
I have two questions. The first is, do you think it's necessary, if they are permitted, to restrict them from participating in the care of that person?
If they are a power of attorney?
Correct. It's okay if you don't have an answer, you can give it to us later.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I would say probably not.
Not that they...
They should not probably care for the person.
Okay. And the second is, there was some testimony yesterday about that same situation, about having close friends in a nursing home facility. Should what you're asking for be broadened to other employees of the nursing home facility that don't have any contact in terms of providing care with the patient?
Who are also power of attorney?
Correct.
A friend that's a power of attorney
who's
taking
an employee
care
of the facility.
Mm-hmm. I would say the same. I don't know, but I would say probably not.
I'm sorry, probably
not
that it should be limited to blood relations who are employees?
No, that they shouldn't take care of the person.
Okay. Do you think, though, they should be able to serve as attorneys in fact?
I don't know.
I don't think her testimony would help us too much.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. Let's have Dr. Stemple, Adler, and Sacco. Can you come up together, the three of you, please? We got three of you here, all three of you.
Dr. Sacco here is a distinguished graduate of the same law school that I am. The doctors got together and decided they should have a doctor room and become a lawyer.
Nobody's perfect.
And he graduated from law school magna cum laude, I believe. He was a very brilliant law school.
Good. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Stemple. I'm a practicing obstetrician and gynecologist in Portland. Senate Bills 20 and 21 raised some concerns for me about the following two patients. The first is a 60-year-old woman who was recently diagnosed with cancer of the ovary. The tumor specialists anticipate her death in 6 to 12 months, although a few of these patients have survived 5 years or more. She was admitted to the hospital with a common complication of ovarian cancer, a bowel obstruction. Conservative treatment of this condition is oftentimes successful. A tube through the nose to the stomach decompresses the bowels. An intravenous solution corrects the dehydration and electrolyte imbalance, which causes her confusion. This patient is, in all probability, in the active and natural process of dying from an ovarian cancer, a process which usually takes 6 to 12 months. But with the simple mechanical means of a nasogastric tube and an IV, her death would not be imminent. She would likely resolve the bowel obstruction to live out the remainder of her months. In fact, a rare patient has actually had spontaneous tumor regression and a permanent cure. In my medical judgment, an NG tube and an IV are treatments that this patient can tolerate. Senate Bill 20, however, allows this woman to sign a directive which permits rejection of this life-sustaining treatment even when death is not imminent. Senate Bill 21 allows her attorney, in fact, to judge that the burdens of an NG and IV outweigh the benefits of 6 months of life and a small chance of long-term survival. My only ethical alternative in this case is to transfer her care. My colleagues, however, are equally reluctant to implement this living will. This is indeed a form of mercy killing. My second dilemma involves a 15-year-old patient who sustained a head injury and is in a coma. She is 4 months pregnant. As part of an adolescent rebellion, she selected her 15-year-old boyfriend as her attorney in fact. After the 60-day waiting period as outlined in Senate Bill 21, he exercised his power of attorney in discontinuing respirator support. Her death shattered her parents' hopes that she may be one of the few that regain consciousness after 60 days. Her death destroyed her parents' hopes for a grandchild who would have survived if left in utero 1 to 2 more months. These are hypothetical cases. They illustrate for me the questions that will confront me if Senate Bills 20 and 21 are passed. First, when removing life-sustaining procedures directly causes death, when death is not otherwise imminent, is this not a form of mercy killing? Two, who should decide if the burdens of treatment outweigh the benefits? The attorney in fact, the family, the doctor, a consensus? Three, is a 15-year-old adolescent capable of making these life and death decisions? Is not the current law more appropriate with an age of 18? Does not the family have the rights in deciding the care of their child? Fourth, who protects the unborn fetus? Do we not have a responsibility to promote the safety of a viable fetus, to delay delivery until maturity? Fifth, what scientific premise dictates that 60 days is the critical time in a coma that assures no chance of recovery? In conclusion, certainly patients and their agents must be involved in the decisions surrounding their death. Current law must be amended to provide for the unusual case in which therapy, including hydration and nutrition, should be withdrawn or withheld. But let us table Senate Bills 20 and 21 and tell these questions that these bills generate are resolved. Thank you.
Of course, it'd be easy enough to know. I'm surprised that you would suggest that that a 15-year-old could hold this power of attorney. If that's correct, then I'm not arguing with you, but it's all news to me. But anyway, of course, that could easily be changed in there.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't look as though it's stipulated, though, in the bill as it's written.
Yeah. All right, go ahead.
My name is Michael Adler. I'm a physician in the Portland area. I'd like to offer my testimony today in opposition to Senate Bill 20 and 21, and I'd also like to submit written testimony by Dr. Peter Kane, who's not able to attend today. Dr. Kane is an oncologist and a cancer therapist. As a physician and a citizen of the state of Oregon, I'd like to offer my opposition to Senate Bills 20 and 21. To begin with, Senate Bill 21, although purporting to be a simple proviso for an attorney in fact, may possibly be revealed really as anti-family legislation. It does this in particular by allowing an attorney in fact to make definitive health care decisions without any required consultation with the patient's family. Although this in fact may be the patient's intent, I feel it helps to continue the unraveling of endangered family values, and therefore I feel it's in society's best interest to reverse this tendency. As an example, under Senate Bill 21, it is quite possible for teenagers involved in suicide pacts to designate an accomplice as their attorney in fact. If as a result of a failed suicide attempt, the victim is comatose, their suicide partner would have the ultimate life and death decision authority without the victim's mother and father having any legal voice in medical decisions made with regard to life-sustaining procedures. Senate Bill 21 offers no legal alternative when disputes arise between decisions made by the attorney in fact and by members of the patient's family. Situations like this will actually make the physician's and hospital's position more precarious in avoiding legal entanglements. Now, my opposition to Senate Bill 20 is on multiple points described briefly. The provision of nutrition and hydration, while currently protected under Oregon statutes as expected norms of medical care, would under Senate Bill 20 be relegated as extraordinary means which may be discontinued in the same manner as respirator and sophisticated medical devices. This is clearly wrong. The provision of nourishment and hydration when we are ill is a human right. It's the expected norm. It's the least we should expect from our society, family, and our physicians when we are ill. Now, there will always be tough situations when it seems that continuance of therapy is fruitless. But unless society presumes in favor of nutrition and hydration, as current statute does, it'll be very intellectually easy to delve into acts of euthanasia. The current law prohibits the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures except in the, quote, the instance of the terminal conditions and imminent death. Senate Bill 20, however, substitutes the phrase with an oxymoron, the active and natural process of dying. Now, this new language is vague and dangerous since all voting citizens of Oregon began the active and natural process of dying immediately after birth. SB 20 makes no provision for the continuance of life support if a pregnant mother's continued life would benefit the life of a fetus. Now, the decision to accept a 60-day limit for the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures in comatose patients is arbitrary and unfounded in neurologic data. Coma is a symptom. It is not a diagnosis. Coma reflects an underlying neurologic pathology with a wide variance in potential outcome, and therefore mandating a 60-day time limit has no basis in fact and removes value protection of patients. As a physician, I resent SB 20's potential for subjecting a physician to charges of unprofessional conduct if he cannot comply with its stipulations out of conscientious objection. And I reject SB 20's clause that nothing in this legislation shall be construed as a violation of a physician's oath. I, the physician, can only decide if my oath has been violated, not the state. In summary, I believe SB 20 and 21 should be rejected due to the potential legal, societal, medical, and family consequences which may result from their enactment. And I request that the committee table both bills. In addendum, if possible, I'd like to comment on some of Senator Wire's questions regarding the withdrawal of hydration and the development of decubitus and medical morale.
Go ahead.
I think that Senator Wire's questions are very apt. Not in all cases with the withdrawal of hydration will decubitus ulcers result, but certainly the chance for them does increase. The medical morale among nursing personnel is very important. Patients are going to suffer with the withdrawal of nutrition and hydration. It's not necessarily a very comfortable way to die, to be starved to death or to be dehydrated. Just because a patient cannot vocalize that they're in pain, do we really know? Do we have medical proof that pain doesn't occur? Sometimes it can take up to several weeks for a patient to dehydrate or to starve. In those events with a patient developing decubitus ulcers, taking longer than the necessary several days to die, to me it intellectually compels someone to say that, look, we've already decided that the patient is going to die. That's why we withdrew the IVs. So conceptually, what's the difference with giving the patient an overdose of narcotics? They're in pain, they have decubitus ulcers. We made the decision that the patient has the right to die, and we have also intellectually decided that that we will hasten the patient's death by withdrawing nutrition and hydration. Ergo, give the patient an overdose and hasten the process. I think this legislation opens up a Pandora's box of legal questions, and from the comments that I've seen tonight regarding the potential amendments, regarding whether a patient has the right to withdraw a directive after they've already signed one and now they're in a confused state, I think is just, I think is mind-boggling. And therefore, I would prefer to see current legislation amended rather than adopting Senate Bill 20 and 21.
Question, Senator Cohen.
How would you recommend current law be amended?
First off, I've talked with a number of physicians that take care of dying patients. Physicians that have been intimately involved in this debate on both sides of the issue in the Portland area. And frankly, they don't see that there's really that much of a problem with current legislation. I think if we try to assume that Senate Bills 20 and 21 are actually going to help some liability problems for physicians, I think we're kidding ourselves. Okay. First off, under current statute, a patient may make a directive that hopefully the physician and the family will follow. It's not cast in concrete as Senate Bills 20 and 21 are. Under current statutes, the physician has to build a consensus among the family and with the nursing personnel if he feels that life-sustaining measures should be withdrawn from a patient. You know, medicine is not necessarily robotics. Medicine still is an art. And the physician, in terms of this, has to make individual decisions in individual cases. You can't legislate for all cases and make amendments to try to fit them for all cases. So in the individual circumstance, the physician has to build a consensus among the nursing personnel. And quite often it's the nursing personnel that go to the physician and says, don't you think that we've done enough? If the family is opposed to the physician and to the nursing, to the recommendations that nutrition and hydration be withdrawn, the physician has a responsibility to follow the family's decisions. He can try to build a consensus and say that, look, your mother or your father told me in this directive a long time ago, they don't want this provided. Let's talk about this. Let's try to come to some type of decision. That's the way a physician is to act. Even under SB 20 and 21, the family is totally opposed to the attorney, in fact, withdrawing life-sustaining measures for the patient. The family has no recourse. And if I'm the physician in the middle of that situation, and I've got the family on one side and the attorney, in fact, on the other side, and SB 20 and 21 says that I have to follow...
assigned a living will directive, and then the family came to me and said, well, we know that grandmother is ill, but we really do want to have everything done and see what happens. And the reasons that I would say, okay, but you understand that grandma did this and so, and this and what her desires are, and they say, we understand. And the reason that I would not necessarily be bound by this directive are two. First of all, every physician is concerned about getting sued. And it is not the terminally ill that do the suing, it's the family members that do the suing. So, in fact, we are concerned about good rapport with family. That is utmost in our minds. Not only rendering good care, but also doing that in a manner that the family understands what's going on and, to a certain extent, complies with that approach to medical care. The other concern is that if a family is concerned that a physician is not doing all that he could or is perhaps doing too much, it is within the power of family to dismiss a physician and find another physician. So that always rests with the family to have that final say, particularly if a patient is incapacitated, terminally ill, on a ventilator, you name it, but cannot make that decision for himself. So that there are inherent weaknesses of living wills that for all the legal maneuvering and all the precision that you might make, when it comes to the hospital corridors, it will still be the family, the patient, and a doctor that will come to the final resolution of this difficult ethical decision. And that brings me to the second point that I'd like to make, and that is the advantage of a durable power of attorney over health care. This is really, I think, a step forward in terms of dealing with these issues. It provides a patient who has a concern, has given some forethought to the way that he would like to die or exit this world, someone who's given that forethought, to go ahead and elect someone that he has confidence in judgment. We would not necessarily delegate our financial matters to a consensus of family members. We would not delegate that to any individual who we did not have faith or confidence in. And the same thing should be true of a person who has concerns about their health in a terminal situation or a near-death situation. You'd want to delegate that to someone who you know has knowledge, perhaps, has the same standards ethically, morally, and that you would feel more confident in that situation. This is a blessing for a physician who has a chance to go in and talk to someone and explain the facts and truly obtain informed consent. Informed consent is something that we are all concerned with as physicians and as recipients of health care. And this, if you sit down in a formal manner and say, okay, I am acting as an agent for this person, and then I, as a physician, could explain to that person what the risks are of a procedure, what the benefits are, what the outlook is, and then a decision could be made, not by negotiation with several members, but in a one-to-one relationship, which would be very, very satisfying. California, as you're aware, has had this for some time, I'm sure. The third concern that I have with Senate Bill 20 that I'd wish to share with you is the third directive. The third directive reads, I want my life to be prolonged to the greatest extent possible without regard to my condition, the chances I have for recovery, or the cost of procedures. I have difficulty with that provision, because anybody who wishes to delegate a living will, well, if you don't want to limit your life support, you really shouldn't delegate a living will. You don't need to have a living will, and then everything would be done to the utmost possible extent. This provision binds a physician and family into going ahead and charging into the abyss with all the flags flying. This could mean respirators running, hyperalimentation. It could mean a great pain and suffering that a family might be bound to honor if someone elects this directive. This directive does not call for any reason. It doesn't call for any reasonable decisions on the part of patients or family. It just says charge on, no matter how much the pain and suffering is. And I think that many physicians would have more difficulty living by that directive than any of the other directives listed in this Senate Bill 20. If someone wishes to have all the flags flying when he dies, then he probably ought not to write a living will at all, and then he'll get all the reasonable care that one could expect in a terminally ill state. I would like to close with just my own personal philosophy on this, and I think that the physician is charged with extending life wherever possible, but he is not charged with prolonging dying. Prolonging dying is pain often, is suffering, is uncomfortable. And a physician that has to or is asked to provide IV or fluids or food for someone so that they can live another week or 10 days in an uncomfortable position is not doing that patient a service. It's a physician's charge to relieve pain and suffering, and sometimes it is morphine. Sometimes it is holding a hand that's more appropriate than giving IVs. And I would not like to be in a position of having to give IV fluids to someone in a nursing home. And I will share you one experience that upset me, and that was in a nursing home where I was called that a patient of mine who was dying, she had a stroke, she had several other illnesses, had stopped eating. And that I said, so? She is dying. Most people stop eating before they die. And they said, well, under the current rules that we cannot have a person in this home who is not eating. And I said, why? She said, well, the medical auditors, the people who look, will say that we are starving her to death and that we want her transferred to the hospital to die. Well, I had to go down to the nursing home, write a lengthy note, call the administrator of the hospital, and explain that under no circumstances was this person to be transferred from the nursing home to the hospital, because if they did so, I would not admit her. And the fact of the matter is, it was a lengthy procedure to get that person to stay in a nursing home. Now, this lady did die. She died with her family members in attendance. She was comfortable. She was looked after. And it was a dignified death. It was not in an IV, not in a hospital with an IV running with cold surroundings. And I think that that is, as physicians, something that we are attuned to. We will be asked to do this more and more as our population ages. It is a concern of all of us, particularly with the high-tech medical care that is now available. We can resuscitate, we can prolong, we can play chess with death for a long, long time, but that is not the role of a physician. It's comfort, concern, and caring.
Thanks very much. Members have questions? Council.
Doctor, Section 7 of the bill talks about comatose patients, and various witnesses before the committee have used the term coma and persistent vegetative state, often interchangeably. I'd like you, if you could, address to the committee what distinction, if any, there is between those two terms, and whether or not, as stated, the term comatose is sufficient to cover both those situations.
Comatose and vegetative state are different. I think this has already been alluded to a certain extent. A person in coma is someone who simply does not respond to external stimuli with a meaningful type of response. A vegetative state could simply mean someone with prolonged Alzheimer's disease. After a while, their mental function ceases, they cannot recognize family, cannot dress, and sometimes cannot even feed themselves. And they will not be in coma because they will sometimes move around, but they're in a vegetative state. And so as you get more and more vegetative, you get closer and closer to a coma. But a coma is simply not responding at all with purposeful stimuli. I'm not sure if that... go ahead.
Is the term persistent vegetative state recognized in the medical community?
Yes, but you're talking shades of gray. I think everyone would say he's comatose. You walk in, he's lying there flat, doesn't look around, and so forth. That would be a coma. There are different shades of coma. Some people are comatose to the fact where they will not respond to pain at all, whatever. Some will respond to pain by moving or turning a head, maybe, but not in any meaningful way, so that there's shades of coma. A vegetative state would be a person who is probably walking around or possibly walking around, has some recognition, but not very much recognition of his surroundings. So, but where you begin to vegetate is certainly a gray zone. You know, I would say some people watching television might be in a vegetative state, but they can be aroused from that state, fortunately. But there you're talking shades of gray. Coma, I think everyone would agree with, that can be recognized and identified. Vegetative is infinite shades of gray. In advanced stages of vegetation, there's no question. But where that starts is subtle.
Further questions? Senator Hamby?
Would language and the incorporation of language that perhaps merely promotes the death, promotes the process of dying?
Pardon me, I didn't quite...
I'm still trying to search for language, and your comatose idea, the questions by counsel regarding coma and comatose led me to think again of the problems that I have with the definition of coma or comatose, as well as... the treatment procedure itself and the withdrawal of treatment. I have problems with treatment being given that merely prolongs the process of dying. Mm-hmm. I guess that's where I'm personally coming from. And I don't know if that kind of language would more clearly state, I think, where many of the proponents are coming from. As well as the language of coma or comatose, I think the Nurses Association alluded to the fact that they were troubled also by the definition of, the lack of definition of coma. And you alluded to, for instance, the flutter of an eyelash occasionally in an individual that has not responded for, 45, 49 days, and all of a sudden eyelashes flutter. I understand there is stronger language following the Baby Doe decision that identifies a chronically and irreversible comatose state. I don't know if that would cover some of the concerns that have been expressed earlier.
I don't think that physicians have too much disagreement about coma. I think that when someone says they came in comatose or are comatose, I think most physicians have in their mind certain things that one would see. First of all, you would not want to see them walking around or moving.
Oh, gosh.
That's, but a vegetative state,
yes,
you might.
Yes, exactly.
There are different levels of coma. Some might respond by pressing in the chest. Someone might come up with an arm and try to get that away. That's a lighter level of coma.
That's right.
But those are, to a certain extent, not the cerebral functioning.
No. But yet, Bill does not define it. It only says state 60 days of coma.
Yes, but I don't think that a physician would have too much trouble with knowing what coma is. You could define it. There are definitions for different stages of coma. And those are readily available. There are different stages, mm-hmm. and those are defined. Mm-hmm. I mean, responding to noxious stimuli, no response, responding by withdrawal. Mm-hmm. But those are to a certain extent brainstem reflexes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They are not the meaningful life that one goes on in his cerebrum. And when cerebrum is dead, meaningful life is over. And I think that most physicians would acknowledge that someone who is in a coma would not have meaningful life or meaningful cerebral activity. And so I think that a vegetative state, you do have some cerebral activity. I mean, it may be very primitive, feeding, looking around, but not much.
Thank you.
All right, further questions? Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
There is a... I did overlook another physician who was on the list, and I put the list aside and forgot to call Dr. Gingrich a while ago, who was to testify. So my apologies, doctor, for skipping over your name, but you have a chance now.
I'm Dr. Richard Gingrich, representing the Multnomah County Medical Society. I would like to diverge just a bit from my written statement to perhaps discuss some of the matters that were brought up earlier this evening. One of the main reasons for developing this bill, Senate Bill 20, was because of the problems with current law. The directive, as was noted before, frequently has not been used. And we felt that this was one of the reasons that the directive was not used, because it was essentially too, quote, legal. It involved too much of a problem for the elderly person to make the directive. Required witnessing procedures, which were difficult for them. And with the new form of the directive, it gives more options for the person. It also helps them to be able to develop it not only with a written statement, but even by verbal statement, or if they're not able to even speak, to be able to, in some affirmative manner, give the directive that the previous law did not allow. Secondly, in the previous law, the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures was allowed only for the comatose patient. From the practical standpoint, this has not necessarily been followed previously. However, if the situation could be challenged, and was so in California some years ago, and two physicians were actually charged with murder because intravenous feedings were withdrawn. The current bill provides for a much broader application of withdrawing of life-sustaining procedures. One of the beneficial spin-offs of this to the practicing physician would be that at the present time, there is reticence or concern about resuscitating patients that appear to have very little chance of regaining consciousness. For instance, a person that has a heart attack at home, they may be resuscitated by the EMTs, and they have lost or have sustained considerable brain damage. when they arrive in the physician's care, it is very difficult for them to be enthusiastic about taking care of this person, realizing that once saddled on the respirator, they may have to keep him on the respirator for an extended period of time because of the restrictions. If with a broader interpretation of the, as is stated in this law or this bill, there will be more enthusiasm about instituting sustaining procedures to see if perhaps there may be one of the small percentage that will respond to it and survive in a meaningful manner. And if he is not, that in the permanent comatose state, these procedures could be removed. In the present time, artificial procedures such as a respirator can be removed. However, the problem is the matter of hydration and nutrition, and that some of these unfortunate individuals will be able to sustain themselves after a period of time without a respirator, but to remain comatose and be required to have the sustaining factors of hydration and nutrition. Concerns have been expressed earlier this evening about the problems of the caretaker seeing a person die. And certainly this is a very real problem and a very sad experience for any caretaker. But as also was expressed, we do see this at other times. The person that's in a long-term comatose state frequently will develop a urinary tract infection, for which, because of this long-term comatose state, it would be decided not to treat this. The tendency at that time with an infection is that if skin breakdown is to occur, it can occur very rapidly. And so the question brought up about decubitus ulcers and withdrawing of hydration also occurs with other forms which of withdrawing of treatment that can occur. For instance, if antibiotics are not given for this urinary tract infection, decubitus ulcers can occur within a day or even almost hours. So this is a problem that we face at the present time. None of these problems are pleasant, and they bring considerable distress to the caretaker, and the long-term persistence of this situation going over and over, also of treatment of this type of person, this individual who is not cognitive, has no sensations at all, his awareness of his surroundings, it brings a considerable distress also to the caretaker. I'd like to address briefly the question of comatose state. It was discussed by others, and I think that it is an excellent question. A definition of coma as a state in which psychological and motor responses to stimulation are completely lost. That we would call that deep coma. In the chronic vegetative state, we might call this moderately deep coma. The psychological and motor responses to stimulation are reduced to a state of rudimentary responses, which may include sleeping, waking, sucking, chewing, and withdrawal, but no awareness of self or their environment. I think this last part of the statement is very pertinent, in that there is absolutely no awareness of the self or the environment. This type of state does not involve any of the higher brain function. The entire cortex of the brain could be removed, and these rudimentary responses could occur. I'd like to address briefly the method of revoking the directive in the bill, it mentions that even, no matter what type of mental state this patient is in, if he wants to revoke the directive, that is his privilege. We felt this was important because many times people looking ahead will see things in an entirely different light than they will at the very moment. And at the very moment when that serious illness is occurring is not the time to give them an IQ test or have a hearing as to their sanity. And realizing that death is a very permanent situation, all options were given to life in this regard. So that is the reason for this, also for the confronting the person that is not does not have the ability to make a decision, but confronting him with the decision of his family and the physicians that life-sustaining procedures should be removed. And even if he is not what we would call sane in that setting, if he disagrees with that, his will is followed. I would like to cease my formal comments at this time and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Very, very good. Thank you for being here, Doctor. Council, I have a question.
Doctor, could you supply us with a copy of the definitions that you read from as to coma and vegetative state?
Yes, I can. I just have them in a written form right now. Could I send them to you in a time
frame? That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. You bet.
All right. Thank you again, Doctor. That concludes the testimony on Senate Bills 20 and 21. 7:17, and I'm going to adjourn this committee meeting tonight unless somebody wants to insist that we continue.
Just, Mr. Chair, a message Council. To the committee members. In your notebooks is a staff measure analysis both of 20 and 21. The one on 20 is about 10 pages long, and it goes through section by section. Between both analyses, about 98 of the 100 issues that have been presented are covered in one way or the other. So between now and the next time we get to work session, perhaps we can look at those.
Where are they on the list?
It's first up in your red notebook.
Okay, thanks. All right, we're adjourned. Now, where are we?
Honestly, Jim, I don't remember.